I'm going to start out by expressing my appreciation to the congregation here, not just for feeding us this afternoon and making us feel so welcome, but for the fact that you have scheduled this meeting and that you have entrusted me to come and to lead the studies this week. It is a responsibility that I want you to understand I take seriously. I want to do you good and no harm. And I hope and pray that together, if we think about the Bible, that we can be strengthened and we can learn and be encouraged to serve God with a greater zeal and with a greater intensity. In 2 Peter chapter 1, there is in that passage this promise that God's divine power, verse 3, has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who has called us by glory and virtue. God has given us everything we need to live. If we'll take the medicine, we'll have what we need. I had an opportunity this week to visit a young man in the hospital. He's about 27 years old. He's not a Christian. And he has had a lot of health problems. And they have begun to wear on him, not just physically, but mentally. He is scheduled for some psychiatric help as well as some serious physical problems that he's having. And he has talked about doing himself harm. And we talked about that. You really want to do yourself harm? He said, I just do not see the point of living anymore. There are a lot of people who reach that point in life. It takes a little longer for some of them. Maybe his circumstance is accelerated his quest a little bit, but the fact is that there are people who come to the realization that life is temporary and life is transient, and the things that we do seem to be small ripples in a big pond that dissipate quickly. The world itself is temporary. And they begin to ask questions like that. What is the point of it all? What's the meaning of it all? Where are you supposed to find satisfaction? Where are you supposed to find fulfillment and contentment in a life that is just surrounded by reminders of how temporary it all is? It is, I think, a point to which all thinking human beings come. They ask that question. It is a point dealt with in the Scripture. There's a book in the Old Testament that those I'm talking to tonight are well familiar with that I think deals with that question specifically, and it's the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a great gift, Ecclesiastes is, and I'm sure it's one that you have valued through the years. I want to spend a few minutes tonight thinking about this book and its message. And I want to make the particular point that this book has the answer, but it first of all identifies for us in such clarity the problem. Ecclesiastes, I've always thought, was a strange name for this book, isn't it? It's a Hebrew book, but it's a Greek title. Ecclesiastes. You can see the word ekklesia in it, can't you? Take the last four letters off and you have ekklesia. We know what that means, ekklesia being the Greek term for the called out. The word church is the word that's translated in the New Testament so oftentimes. Ecclesiastes or Koheleth in the Hebrew both have the same meaning. It's translated in the English by the word preacher in the King James translation. It calls to mind the man who does the calling out. Solomon in particular here
Acts is the wise man who calls us out and calls us to sit at His feet that we might learn, that we might learn the lesson of life. And he starts out in pretty grim terms. You remember the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he takes under the sun?" One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. "The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where he rose. And the wind goes around toward the south and turns unto the north. It whirls about continually, and the wind returns again to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again." All these points simply reminding us of the monotonous nature of life. You know, people live and they die, then another generation comes and goes, and likewise, and on and on and on. "All things are full of labor," verse 8. "A man cannot utter it," or cannot, he says, "explain it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that thing which shall be done. There is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us." You know how true that is. We think that our generation is so much different because we have more complicated toys. But when you read the Bible, for example, you know, the same problem that you see in people 3,000 years ago. You have love and you have jealousy and you have bitterness and you have the same problem. Sin is not any different. Men and women are not any different. He goes on. Verse 11. "There is no remembrance of former things. Neither shall there be any remembrance of the things that are to come with those that shall come after." I was talking this afternoon about the fact that my family, my mother and father's family, from Clay County, Alabama, originally. I never lived in Clay County. But there are some old cemeteries down there where you can go and you can find the relatives that have been buried through the years. And what strikes me is that maybe this is just a peculiar aspect of my family, but not entirely. There are a lot of names on those tombstones I don't know anything about. Or if I know, I know simply the name. I didn't know my great uncle Mallard. He died when he was 18 years old, and that was 1918, I think. I don't know what kind of man he was. I don't know what his sense of humor was like. I just, he's a name on the tombstone. And you know, even if we have a pretty close family, and even if we have several generations living close together, it doesn't take many generations before people die. And then their memory is forgotten. And I got news for me. You know, if the world stands, that's going to be me one day. And my name on a tombstone, if somebody's going to come by and say, "Wes Crowder, what is that one?" I don't know. Probably kin to us somehow. This is life. This is life under the sun. And Solomon looks at this life and he says, where is the meaning in it all? Where's the value? Where can we find contentment and fulfillment in a world that is so transient and temporary? I believe that the book of Ecclesiastes is a large measure a retelling of Solomon's exploring that question. What kind of life makes life worth living? It's over in the first chapter, verse 13, where Solomon writes, "I gave my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all things that were done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith." He's talking here about the experience of mankind generally. There's something about the way we're made that searches for meaning. My daughter, who's here with us tonight, has two cats at our house. two of the laziest creatures that the Lord ever made, surely. Maybe that's just the breed, the species. I don't know. But I see those cats and, stumble over them sometimes. And there they are. I don't think those cats sit around worrying about life and death and problems. They're just not made to do that. But man is not an animal. One way I know that is because he doesn't think like an animal. A man might be so degraded sometimes as to erase some of the border, but man is made a higher being. And questions of eternity, it's in this very book in chapter 3 where he writes about how God placed eternity in man's heart, Olam. That sense of something higher. That sense in us that demands meaning. We want to make sense of life. We don't want to waste our life. It may take a fellow till mid-age crisis, whatever term you want to use, and he gets to scrambling around and realizes that half his life or more is gone, and he just feels frustrated, and he doesn't know which way to turn. This is the travail that humanity struggles with. And Solomon in particular says, I sought meaning in life. In chapter 2 and verse 12, he also adds this point that certainly is not bragging, it's just a fact. I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what can the man do that comes after the king? Only what has already been done. All of us, in some measure or another, ask these questions. What is life all about? Why am I here? What should I be doing? Solomon says, you can look down a lot of road, but you will never be able to go further than I've gone. I'm the king. I've got the money, I've got the power, I've got the ability, and I have searched it out for you. And if you are wise, you will listen to me. And you won't have to go down every dead-end road to find it out. You can hear me, and I'll tell you. And He will. By the Holy Spirit, He'll tell you and He'll tell me tonight if we'll listen. We can avoid a lot of heartache, and we can certainly have our faith strengthened, I believe, by the message of this book. Solomon did explore a lot of roads. He describes it as wisdom, madness, and folly. And I believe that's exactly right. Solomon explored a lot of things that men still today think will bring them satisfaction and peace. Learning. Human wisdom, I think, is what he has in mind here in particular. If you look with me in chapter 1 and verse 16, he writes, I communed with my own heart, saying, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I don't believe that, again, was bragging.
Or if we find those kinds of people who have that kind of wisdom and that kind of learning, that surely they have got it all figured out. I heard a fellow say years ago, I believe it's exactly right. He said, we live in a post-religious society. We want to look at God and the God of the world. If we find God as being that which people see as a talent, somebody can claim science has shown this. That's what all other questions. And we've got to change the Bible to fit science because science tells us this. Well, okay, well, not buying the idea that everything is all science. It's infallible. But there is the idea that those, you know, talk about people like Stephen Hawking and these other brilliant physicists. Surely they, because of their great vantage point, they can see things clearly. They are just close to figuring out the theory of everything. Just on the verge of getting it all figured out. I know something is solid. Solid is back to me. And he said in chapter 1 and verse 18, in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge is wisdom. I'm not on the level of wisdom, but I think he would be on my level. Just because you're receiving more and more information, more and more things, doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't make sense. There's no generation ever lived on the earth, I suppose, that is more than more than God. If you have a television, you can pay a cable bill. You've probably got five different news channels. See, all the time, plus Disney channels. And they can bring in more bad news than you can deal with. If there's a bus that runs off the road in Kentucky, you know it right now. They've got the film that there's an earthquake in China and somebody's bleeding. Close up is right there. Just knowing more and more does not bring part of maybe what Solomon meant when he said. If there's grief involved in learning, has to do with what he wrote over the seventh chapter about the same subject. And he wrote, all this I have proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise. It was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? Solomon was a truly wise man. I tell you, he had the characteristics of wise men. That is, other people, they're not looking in that direction. What they are looking for is they want a party. Well, party is a verb in English. Party. We want a party. People mean by that. Oh, we're going to break out the root cards and drink Kool-Aid all night. There's nothing new about that. Look with me over in chapter 2. Verse 1. I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. It's also vanity. I said a blasphemy, it is madness, it is mirth, what can you do? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly. Till I might see what was that good for the sons of men that they should do under heaven all the days of their life. I was looking for that something that fills the empty space, and I thought about wine, women, and song.
That stretches my imagination. I can't imagine such a thing.
I don't know how he remembered the names of all these men. But let's have to try to have a relationship with them.
Now, those who believe to this day that because they're so
empty inside, what will make them happy
will be just serial fornicating, one after another after another. The more women you can sleep with, all that makes you a man, and that'll make you happy. Make Solomon happy. You don't have to have 1,000 women or 10,000 women or whatever some outrageous claim people make. Solomon said, I've been there.
And I'll tell you what I found about it. I found that it was empty, and I found that it was bitter. You can go down to, look at chapter 7 and verse 25. Verse 26, really. I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by. I live over in the edge of Jefferson County. And I live not too far, I'm ashamed to say, from an old beer joint that has been there, it claims, on the side of the building since the 20s. It just so happens that for a short time, my mother, who is 87, lived with her family when she was still at home on a farm someplace not too far from where we happen to live right now. And we were driving by there one day, and I asked her, I said, Mom, do you happen to remember hearing about this place when you were a kid? And she said, yes, and decent people didn't go in there then. But a lot of people do. You know what they're looking for? In the bottom of that glass, they're looking for something to make them happy, to make them forget, to make it all go away, for peace. You know what Solomon said about all that? You remember what he wrote in chapter 7. And in verse 2, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. That sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. That's a very graphic illustration, isn't it? You want to build a fire, don't go out and grab a bunch of thorns. You throw them in there, they'll just make a bunch of noise, and they're not going to give you any heat. You don't get any good out of that. The good that comes, he says, does not come from the house of mirth, but the house of mourning. That's where you find the real, true lessons of life. Otherwise, what you find is distraction that does you no good. If people every day who seek pleasure, Solomon said, I've been down that road, and I can tell you, it does not give you what it promises. Well, what about possessions? I think these first three are hard to miss in our world today, especially these last two. Materialism is a chronic disease in our country. People believe if they could just make a little more. If I could just get a house in this neighborhood, if I could ever drive this kind of car. One guy told me if I could ever make $200,000, then that'd be it. $200,000 a year. You know, I thought about that. $200,000 a year, that wouldn't pay, $200,000 wouldn't pay Solomon's food bill for a month. So you read back in the histories about Solomon and about his house. It described this palace, the house of the forest of Lebanon. The beams so big it looked like a forest. We have the account of the Queen of Sheba who came. She couldn't get over how the servants were dressed. It tells us that in Solomon's time, in 1 year, he brought in 666 talents of gold. By conservative estimates, trying to convert that into our money, it'd certainly be well near $1 billion. We're talking about Bill Gates' money. You know, sometimes you can tell the wealth and splendor of a great house by the way they feed themselves and by how many people eat at the king's table. I think it's in 1 Kings 4 you have an account of the daily provision. Every day, killed and served on Solomon's table. Every day, 100 sheep. Plus 30 head of cattle a day. Plus deer. Plus fowl. Plus, I think it was 70 bushels of wheat a day. He writes about all the things that he owned and he controlled. I made me great works. I built houses and planted vineyards and gardens and orchards and pools of water and servants and maidens and cattle above all that were in Jerusalem. Silver and gold, precious treasure of the kings, I was great, verse 9, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. In verse 11, he wrote, and I looked on all my works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and it was vexation and vanity, and there was no profit under the sun. And one reason I know that fellow who looked me in the eye and told me $200,000 a year would make him happy, but it didn't make Solomon happy. If a man loves money that much, if he thinks about it that much, if he goes to bed thinking about it and wakes up thinking about it, if he puts it ahead of his family, if he puts it ahead of his integrity, if he puts it ahead of God, I promise you, it won't ever make him happy no matter how much he's got. Solomon wrote in the 5th chapter of Ecclesiastes some lessons that America needs, that Wes Brown needs, all of us need. He wrote in verse 10, he that loves silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Count on it. There's never enough for the man who loves it. When goods increase, verse 11, they are increased that eat them. And what is the good thereof to the owners, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? Do we not know that? I don't care what income level you're on. Have you ever noticed that principle? That when you get a raise, you just tend to write more checks? It just sort of flows through the house. Somehow it doesn't stick. Solomon knew that. He wrote in verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. That a laboring man who has the right attitude can sleep a lot better than the fellow who's got more. I don't remember who it was, but I remember this point made, and I thought it was a good one. They said, you know, I have learned through the years that you start out as a young married couple and you have nearly nothing. You can put all your possessions in the back nearly of a pickup truck. And then 40 years later, I've got so much more stuff. I got a house full of stuff. And what I've got is a bunch of stuff that I got to paint, I've got to wash, and I've got to pay insurance on and lock up. The more things I possess, the more things tend to possess me. And isn't that true? Isn't that so? That's what Solomon said. He could have told me that. And he did. Verse 13, he talks about another evil. Riches hoarded to their own hurt which is perishing by evil travail. A man who has plans to give away this and that to his son, and then he finds out at the end he doesn't have anything left because providence has taken it away from him. He writes in verse 16, "It is a sore evil in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind?" Isn't that right? A man labors, and he labors for the wind. The other things that maybe people think will find bring fulfillment, they think really a life worth living. I don't know if justice comes to your mind immediately or not, but I think there have always been people who have as their purpose to try somehow to bring utopia to the earth. Does the name H.G. Wells ring a bell with you? I'm sure it does. I'm not a reader of science fiction, but his works are those that have been popular through time. I think he wrote The Invisible Man, and he wrote The Time Machine. I think he wrote The War of the Worlds, and I don't know a bunch of them. This is not one of his fiction works. This is a book that I picked up several years ago. It's a 1922 copy, originally, of his Outline of History. Wells was also a socialist, and he was a humanist. He's one of these people that believe that man contained the answers to his problems. Man can fix his own problems. So he gave us a history of mankind. And then at the end of this book, he writes a chapter. Again, this is written about 1919. Okay, he writes a chapter about the next stage in history. And he writes, "If our outline has been faithfully drawn..." By the way, I don't think it has been faithfully drawn. He starts off with evolution. He starts off with Piltdown Man. I remember Piltdown Man. You know that story, which was a hoax. Somebody took a human skull and I think it was an orangutan jaw and convinced scientists, biologists for 40 years, I believe it was, that this was some sort of a stage in evolution. Anyway... But let's just let that go for now. He says, you know, if you've been following along, in other words, he says, you know that our wars, our social conflicts, our enormous economic stresses are all aspects of adjustment. Our one true state, this state that is already beginning, this state which is to which every man owes his utmost political effort, is now this federal world state to which human necessity points. What he's talking about is he believed that we ought to get rid of the Christianity and all these religions that divide us and all these nationalities and just be one world state. And that would just bring and usher in unprecedented prosperity. People would get along. You know, it'd never rain on Saturdays. It'd just be terrific. All the economic organizations that exploit now will now have a fresh possibility. He writes about, there will be no armies, no navies, no classes of unemployed people, either wealthy or poor. And he sees that we're on the verge of this in 1919. I'm talking to students of history, and you know that within 10 years, roughly, of writing those words, Joseph Stalin rose to power in Moscow. And Adolf Hitler rose to power in Berlin. And between those two fellows, they killed 14 million people. I'm not talking about in the war. I'm not talking about soldiers and battles. I'm talking about going into villages, lining up people because they were Poles, because they were Slavs, because they were Jews, lining them up and shooting them in the back of the head, men, women, and children, or putting them in gas chambers. We didn't get the utopia. Now, I use an example that's 90 years old to make that point. But every generation has its guys like that, who, if they live too long, die disillusioned. And to some extent or another, you see this soul. Oh, if we just had this party in Washington, if we just get this change in the government, we're going to have a war on poverty. We're going to have a war on war.
I'm not saying that to be mocking. I'm not suggesting that it's wrong to try to help people or wrong to try to make things better. That's not my point. Folks in need, help them out. But there are people who really believe we don't need God. I think it was attributed to Mr. Kennedy, to President Kennedy. I may be a misquote, but I think he was one of the fellows who said, our problems are man-made and man can solve them. He was half right. I promise you, heaven is not going to be on this earth. Let's do all we can to help our neighbor. The Lord taught us that. But we're not going to find heaven here. And if we think we are, we're going to die disillusioned as these fellows did. Solomon, let me get to Solomon. What he said about it, he knew that. You think that the king could help that out? You think if you were king, you could stop trouble in your kingdom? Look in chapter 4 and verse 1. I returned and considered all the oppressions that were done under the sun, and behold the tears of such that were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on their side, or on the side, I'm sorry, of their oppressors, there was power, but they had no comforter. I praise the dead which were already dead more than the living that were yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they that hath not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work done under the sun. Solomon said, I was king and I couldn't stop it. Well, there are some who think that the praise and fame that comes with life. I know I'm out of touch in terms of the common media market and so on. I admit that I'm, but I find people talked about it and names mentioned, and I ask people, who is that? They've got this television show and people talking about, who is this person? And nobody knows. They're just famous for being famous. Famous for being outrageous. Shameless. Well, to some people, that's all that matters. People know my name. It doesn't last. In the fourth chapter, verse 13, I'm reading this from the American Standard Translation. Solomon writes, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who knows not how to receive admonition anymore. He came out of prison to be king. Yea, even his kingdom, he was born poor. I saw all the living that walk under the sun, that they were with the youth, the second, that stood up in his stead. There's no end of all the people, even all them over whom he was, yet they that come after shall not rejoice in him. This also is vanity. The fellow said, everybody's famous for 15 minutes. Even a king has his 15 minutes. And you know what happens? He gets old and he dies and he's forgotten and somebody else comes along. You see these young men who think that they are it because they can run fast or they can catch the ball or they can shoot a goal. And so they are the big star. But you know what happens? The year after they're gone, they give his number to some other kid. He runs up and down the field and breaks every record. Nobody remembers him. This is the way it is. If we hang in our whole existence on fame and acclaim, and we'll find that to be bitterly empty. Even the king found it to be so. Somebody says, what we need is religion. Well, it depends on what kind of religion. In chapter 5, Solomon writes, keep your foot when you go to the house of God and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. For they consider not that they do evil. And he goes on to explain, be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. God is in heaven. Thou art upon the earth. Therefore let thy words be few. He defines in this context, I believe, the idea of the sacrifice of fools, by saying that he's talking about those who talk religion but don't live it. I've met people who have told me, and maybe you've had the same experience. I've tried Christianity. It didn't work for me. You know, the response is, you didn't try. Because it works if you try. You can play at it. You can talk about it. You can paddle around on the surface, but you're not going to find the value in it with that. That kind of mere outward form of religion is just as foolish as the rest of them. No, it won't find any. There won't be any. There's just 100 dead-end roads. These are some of those that Solomon wrote about. He wrote this in chapter 7, verse 29. God made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions, or the English Standard Version says, many schemes, and they still do. So what's the answer? My time is about up, but I want to, if you'll bear with me a minute before we quit, I want to get to the good news. Because there is an answer. In the book of Ecclesiastes, some, because they maybe don't appreciate the context or because they are unfair with it, they can make it to be a gloomy book. It's a gloomy book in pointing out the reality that if you live life under the sun with no higher ambition than just getting full when you're hungry and doing what you want to, life is meaningless. That's exactly right. But there is something that makes life useful and meaningful. What is the conclusion of the whole matter? You know as well as I do. In chapter 12 and verse 13. Dear God, keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. You want to find real peace and happiness? That's where it starts. Know God. Truly know God and give Him His place. In the first place, recognize that there is a God. You know, I was reading, referring to Mr. Wells' book. He's got a chapter in the early chapters here where he talks about the origin of life. Would you like to see what H.G. Wells, I wonder what his IQ was. You could probably take mine and double it. You wouldn't quite reach his. But you'll know what he writes about the history and origin of life. Chapter 2, verse 1. We do not know how life began upon the earth. Surprise, surprise. I was in a bookstore in Tennessee, and they had a little kids section there, the science section for kids, and I pulled out this book, and it was a book on the universe. That sounds good. So I opened up the book, and the first chapter, the first line was, "In the beginning." This sounds familiar. He went on to say, in the beginning, there was absolutely nothing. Now, that's a message of hope, isn't it? You know, not only is it hopeless, it just doesn't make good nonsense. I don't remember exactly. I'm paraphrasing now. But that was a quote. Then he said, there wasn't a rock, there wasn't a tree, there wasn't an atom, there was nothing. And all of a sudden there was something, and then from there we can tell you how it all came. I've got, just so happens tonight, it's appropriate that I'm looking at my watch, but I've got a watch here. This is the cheapest watch I've ever had. It's, I don't wear expensive watches, period, but this is a truly cheap watch. It's so cheap, it doesn't even have a name on it. You ever had a watch that cheap? It's a shame to put a name on it. But the problem is it won't quit running, I can't get another one. You know, I mean, if it broke, I could, you know, get a Timex. But anyway, you know, it does not have a name on it. But I know somebody made it. If you ask me who made this watch, and I said to you, well, that's interesting you ask that because I have a theory that I've been working on that I've come to be truly convicted of. I believe that somewhere out near where I live, there was a great explosion. There was sand in the ground and the heat from the explosion formed and fused and glass and metals in the earth and the explosion shaped and molded. And then, over millions and millions of years, slowly, steadily, all the parts came together. And that's where this watch came from. That's what I believe. You'd say, that's nuts. Well, it is nuts. This is a $5 watch. The $5 watch didn't make itself. It didn't come by itself. The whole universe came about that watch.
not a smart fellow. How does that bind me? I just think that's pure nonsense. I don't have the answer to every question. I acknowledge that. But I tell you, a question they don't have the answer to. No matter how smart they are, Mr. Wells had the answer. Where did it all come from? And how did life come from nothing? The things that are made cry out for the existence of God. That was Paul's point in Romans. And if we don't start with that recognition, we're not ever going to find anything but darkness. That's just the truth of it. Now, the second point in relation to that is, once we recognize there is a God, we're going to have to recognize that He speaks to us. He didn't make us for no purpose. And in His Word, we find a message. If God made me, He surely made me with the desire in mind to do something. And He communicates to me what that is. And though it's beyond our ability tonight to talk about, there is no communication that compares with the Bible. There are other records and revelations that are offered. There are not any of them that compare with the Scripture. In this book, God directs me. And if He directs me, then He also is going to call me to account. And I think this is really why people deny the obvious fact of God. We don't want to deal with the accounting. And we don't like the idea of being under discipline. But the point that Ecclesiastes made 3,000 years ago, if you do not accept these realities, you will never find happiness. You will never find joy. You will never find contentment. You just find distraction. And you die either in fear or with your senses so blunted that you just don't know. Begin with the knowledge and recognition of God giving Him His place. In the second place, I would offer this quickly. Look in chapter 3. Trust God. I don't know more familiar words maybe in the book of Ecclesiastes. Some of the most familiar words are found here. You hear them quoted. They're written into songs. You see them on placards and all kinds of places. But what do they mean when he writes, to everything there is a time, a purpose under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, to plant and to pluck up what's planted, to kill and to heal, to break down and to build up, to weep and to laugh, and so on. What is he talking about there? I don't think he's saying that all these things are right. But I think he's saying that in life we experience all these extremes. But ultimately, the point that he makes, it seems to me, is in verse 16. When after saying these things, he writes, I saw under the sun the place of judgment and wickedness was there. And the place of righteousness and iniquity was there. And I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every work, for every purpose, he says, and for every work. What he's telling me is that in life you're going to find all kinds of experiences. But don't forget this comforting and important fact, that God's hand in it all. That when you see right where righteousness ought to be, wickedness there, when you see trouble, remember this, that there is a time and there is a purpose. And that does give me comfort. You know, we ought never to read that passage in chapter 4 that we read earlier about the tears of the oppressed and there was no comforter without reading chapter 5 and verse 8, in which Solomon asserts this truth. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in the province, and we will, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. It was sort of made as our theme of the week, the idea of being immersed in the knowledge of God, things that pertain to life and godliness. In that same letter, in 2 Peter chapter 2, and in verse 9, Peter gives us something that will give us comfort and stability. Have you ever heard somebody say, have you ever said,
Well, I tell you, things are getting so bad in this world. I don't know what's going to happen to our grandchildren. What's going to happen to our children? We may not live to see it, but it's going to be terrible. I just don't know what's going to happen. Well, before I get too carried away with all that, I ought to remember something. And I'm sure we do. That Peter wrote here. He writes about Sodom and Gomorrah. And he writes about the flood. And he reminds us in verse 9 of 2 Peter 2 that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. It gives me a great deal of comfort to remember that fact, that no matter how bad things get, that God is in control and He'll take care of His own. That allows us to live and to enjoy life. And we are called to enjoy life. I don't know how the idea would come forth that Christians somehow, if they sit on attack or if they make themselves miserable, that somehow that puts them closer to God. That's certainly not the message of Ecclesiastes, is it? One passage, and there are many we could read, but one here, in which in chapter 5 and verse 18, Solomon writes, "This I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, to enjoy all the good of his labor that God has given him. It is his portion, every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and great power to eat." Does Ecclesiastes teach us it's wrong to have wealth? It's wrong to have plenty? Not at all. It teaches us not to serve it, not to love it. And to the man who does not love things, he truly is the only man that can really enjoy them. The man who loves them is miserable. He's so busy trying to get the next thing, he can't enjoy what he's got. It's to the man who has learned the secret of contentment, as Paul will write later in Philippians. He can enjoy it when he has more than enough. He can live with it when he does. You want to find fulfillment in life? Get a perspective like that. That'll help. Find it. Help other people. You want to find contentment? You want to find something that fills a void? Cast your bread upon the waters. Thou shalt find it after many days. Give portion to seven and also to eight. You want to gain, give. Be generous. And God will bless you for it, and you'll be glad and be the better for it. A lot to be said about that, but we'll let that suffice for now. Let me, in conclusion, I thank you for your kind attention. Make two quick points. I think of this lesson that Solomon teaches all of us, and I think it has certain application to those who are apart from God. For those who do not know this joy. I think what God calls us to do is to make our life count. To put down the distraction and all these, get out of these dead end roads and come back to reality. Find true purpose. Find real peace. Not just for now, but for eternity. And I would certainly amen that. And it also speaks to me as one who claims to be a child of God. You ever meet Christians who just seem miserable? I remember a brother years ago made this point. He said, there's something dreadfully wrong when Christians who claim to have peace with God do not display the peace of God that passes all understanding. And that's right. I mean, all of us have tough days. Not every day is a day we're just grinning and laughing about. I understand. We all understand. But in the end, if it's real, then we know who we are and where we're going. And we're not crushed like the world is crushed. And we're not in the same rat race that they're in. I can never, and you can never, lead the world by following them. We can never allow ourselves to sink down to the same meaningless, useless, limited vision that they have. We've got to show them a better way. Let's commit ourselves to doing that. If we've not done a good job of that, to do a better job. That goes for me, and I trust that will be helpful to you as well. Thank you for your kind attention tonight. Please get out your songbooks. Turn to the number that's been selected.